The meeting of the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. It is Tuesday, February 17th, and I'm sorry, people, we didn't know exactly what time we'd get started, but it became clear that the Capital Investment Committee was going to go. I think it's probably just winding up now. There are six of our members who serve on that, and we only have 11 of us anyway. So, Senator Higgins, thank you for being flexible, and to all of you who are waiting patiently, thank you.
It gave me a chance to eat my lunch, so thank you.
And actually being kept waiting for 15 minutes isn't probably as long as waiting for 6 or 7 years, Senator Higgins. Anyway, we are going to hear today your proposal about changing certification to licensing for interior designers. And we have a lot of people to testify, so I'll let you begin.
Madam Chair, to start with, I have an author's amendment. This is the first committee for this bill. It's the A1 amendment. If someone would be kind enough to move that one.
Senator Prettner-Solin moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, the existing law relating to interior design causes a threat to the public's health, safety, and welfare. A Title Act was passed in 1992, which is actually a voluntary title certification law. It only prohibits people from calling themselves a certified interior designer unless they meet certain qualifications. The bill is to regulate the practice of licensed interior design, the bill that's before you. This is important for all the reasons discussed in the report provided by the Minnesota Interior Design Legislative Action Committee that you have. I believe each of you has a copy. While licensing efforts are occurring in other parts of the country, Senate File 376 is unique to Minnesota. Nationally, the American Institute of Architects and the National Kitchen and Bath Association are opposing all licensure efforts by interior designers. However, in Minnesota, interior designers and other professionals who work in and around the built environment are regulated by the Board of Architects, Engineers, Land Surveyors, Landscape Architects, Geologists, Soil Scientists, and Interior Designers. Proposed definitions and exemptions for interior designers in this bill mirrors the definitions of the other professions under this board. That makes this legislation unique to Minnesota. Another thing that makes this language different is what some other states have tried, including Texas, is that this bill will not impact anyone's ability to call himself or herself an interior designer. Anyone, including me, who has no experience in this field at all, can use that term. What individuals won't be able to do is hold themselves out as licensed if they are not. There are no First Amendment issues with this legislation, as has been an issue in other states. This bill does not affect 1 and 2 family residences or certain commercial spaces, as they are currently exempt for all the professions regulated by that board with all those businesses.
With a very difficult acronym.
AELSLAGID. Board. That's a doozy. This bill does not impact those exemptions. This bill would also allow those who work in sales or representations of goods in either the residential or commercial markets to continue their work without being licensed. Your salesperson at Home Depot, for example, will not be impacted by this bill. However, under existing law, unqualified persons are not prohibited from designing the interior environments of public spaces, elementary schools, restaurants, hotels, office buildings, hospitals, nursing homes. Worse yet, the public does not know why they, their children, their parents, their friends, and their colleagues are at risk. Licensed interior design would encompass a lot more than decoration. Through education, experience, and examination, expertise is developed regarding building codes, space planning, room egress, and interior layout of non-load-bearing walls. Licensed interior designers would specify materials, finishings, and furnishings that are required to meet various codes. They would design lighting, space plans, and workstations that provide safe environments that support improved performance. They know about toxins, indoor air quality, ergonomics, slip resistance, signage, all building codes that affect the interior of a building. Yes, they know about color, too. Interior design is the only group on the board with the really long name that is not licensed. And the built environment has become too complex for the design of interior environments to not be regulated anymore. Architects do not have all the specialized knowledge that interior designers do when it comes to the design and specification of interior environments. One of the highest risk environments is the one that is remodeled or renovated and does not require an architect because no load-bearing walls are involved. All public interior spaces such as hospitals, schools, hotels, offices, banks, and casinos go through this type of renovation quite regularly, but don't call in architects. Therefore, there is no qualified design professional required to do this work. This bill will not put anybody out of business. There is no cost to this bill. All other areas of interior design are still needed by the public, and these jobs will continue undisturbed. The persons practicing interior design who decide not to become licensed can still call themselves interior designers, or a lot of other terms that are out there. As is true in a lot of fields, there are multiple pathways and types of education and experience options for employment for those who want to be part of this field. These will still be available after passage. The interior design profession has education, examination, and experience standards in place that reflect their knowledge of designing to prevent harm to the public. The public interest is poorly served if there are no standards or accountability measures in place that help consumers assess the qualifications of an interior designer working in a commercial space. It is time to put health, safety, and welfare of Minnesotans that we represent first. Madam Chair, I know there's a long list of people who want to testify, and I believe there's a team of people who are going to come up and be the first testifiers. We would like to start with Janice Linster.
Yes. Ms. Linster, if you just identify yourselves for the record when you speak, then that would be helpful. Welcome.
Thank you. Maybe along this side. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much. My name is Janice Linster. I'm a certified interior designer, and I've also had the opportunity to fulfill a term as interior design representative on the regulating board. I have practiced interior design for over 25 years, working in large, medium, and small architecture and interior design firms, and I am now an owner of an interior design and architecture practice with two other partners. Our firm focuses primarily on the interior environment, and our projects range in size from a few thousand square feet to a few hundred thousand square feet. We are often involved in collaborative partnerships with other firms on freestanding developments where our firm leads the interior design role and the partner firm leads the design of the core and shell or the outside structure of the building. The majority of the time, however, we are the lead design firm, usually the only design firm, designing and documenting interior spaces in buildings that already exist. My objective today is to explain the overall scope of work we are referring to when we talk about the need for licensing. This is about interior design in public spaces such as schools, hospital, retail, and corporate offices. I'm going to walk you through, in a simplified fashion, a typical scope of services on a project for an office tenant relocating into an existing building where mechanical, electrical, structural infrastructure, and building exiting are all in place. The interior design scope of services might include the following. We begin with a program of clients' needs and an overall description of the scope of work. We field verify the existing layout, document the building type, and make note of existing conditions affecting our planning, as well as any items that are no longer co-compliant. We evaluate the need for other consultants, such as structural, mechanical, and electrical engineers, based on the existing conditions and the new scope of work. In the planning phase, we begin the development of floor plans, where we are locating walls, doors, and furniture. Sometimes we are using a great deal of the existing conditions, and sometimes we assume the majority of the existing walls will be removed. In addition to the creative and functional aspects of this plan, we will consider a number of code issues, such as the path to exits, the width of exits, accessibility and compliance with our Minnesota Accessibility Code and the Americans with Disabilities Act in areas such as restrooms, pathway widths, workstations, signage, and millwork or cabinetry in areas such as break rooms and reception areas, assuring they are an accessible height. We also investigate restroom occupancy and quantity of fixtures needed. We look at necessary fire ratings of walls and door construction. This is just a list of examples and not an inclusive list. As we develop our design, in the early phases, we meet or correspond with code officials to review any plan concerns, and then we begin to refine our floor plans and develop details and specifications. We are also preparing reflected ceiling plans that describe location and material of all ceiling products, location and specification of light fixtures, and location of exit signs. We select materials that meet aesthetic and durability requirements along with vertical and horizontal flame spread ratings, slip resistance, and mold resistance. We document power and data locations. And we consider appropriate materials and design concepts that contribute to USGBC's LEED programs or sustainable and green concepts that benefit our environment. With regard to furniture, we select and specify furniture for the environment considering ergonomics, accessibility, and function, and we coordinate big packages for procurement by others. In the construction documents phase, we prepare a final set of detailed drawings and specifications prepared and issued for permit and construction pricing. And during the construction process, we monitor construction to assure that it is conforming with our documentation. The work I've described is the type of project that my interior design staff and I were trained for through our education, our experience, and our examination. This is interior design being practiced to its fullest extent, consistent with the profession's current requirements to practice. As with many professions, there's certainly overlap between architecture and interior design, as well as overlap between decorating and interior design. Our goal with licensing is to distinguish those who have the appropriate education, experience, and examination to design full-scope projects impacting health, safety, and welfare of the public. We cannot assume code officials nor the Better Business Bureau will be gatekeepers. As with many tiered professions, there are a variety of markets and jobs for those who practice a different, more limited scope of interior design. Consistent with all disciplines regulated by the Minnesota Licensing Board, single-family residential work and small-scale projects will continue to be exempt, allowing the remainder of the profession, including residential and kitchen and bath designers, to practice under this legislation and continue calling themselves interior designers. When we speak of licensing interior design, we are referring really only to the segment of the population falling under the interior design umbrella. While our education and examination has evolved over the years to maintain pace with the knowledge gained from research, from real-life experience, and from change that continues to occur all around us, the title interior designer has stretched to cover those who are highly trained and educated, who are impacting our experience, our health, and our safety through the design of an endless list of environments. This same title applies to those with no education who may be very talented at color, decor, and arrangement and provide a service very different from the scope I have just described. The public interest is poorly served without an Interior Design Practice Act that would allow consumers to determine if someone is qualified to protect their health, safety, and welfare in the design of public spaces. I would also like to read a letter from architect William Hickey, who is a member of the American Institute of Architects and an owner of an architecture, engineering, and interior design firm. Bill writes, "Dear Senator Scheid, I had planned to testify at the hearing for Senate File 376, but unfortunately, I will be out of town the week it is scheduled. I am asking that this statement be read during the hearing for the benefit of the committee members. I am writing you in enthusiastic support of Senate File 376. I am a business owner who employs over 30 people in Minneapolis. Our firm is composed of architects, interior designers, structural engineers, historic preservationists, and other professionals. It is a matter of great urgency to move this matter forward and provide appropriate professional credentials, Practice Act, and licensure for qualified interior designers. In particular, As an architect, I want to address some of the misconceptions and misstatements spread by some in the industry. There is resistance to this effort in some parts of the architectural community. In my opinion, this is based on misguided turf protecting and simple ignorance. Licensure of interior designers will not have an adverse effect on the business of architecture. It will, in fact, enhance it. Most architectural firms employ interior designers. This will continue. We will still compete, as we do now, with a few pure interior design firms. What will change is that we will be able to offer a constant level of skill and credential to our clients. The public will be able to have a firm understanding of the professional level of a licensed interior designer. Furthermore, there are no new overlaps or conflicts with established architecture or structural criteria. Licensed interior designers will not deal with structural portions of buildings. Instead, they will be able to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public with a credentialed level of experience in all aspects of the built environment that they deal with. This Practice Act will protect the public by establishing consistent accountability and responsibility of those who are qualified to practice interior design in spaces beyond those types classified as exempt. Very truly yours, William Hickey, Collaborative Design Group.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Denise Guerin. I'm Director of the Interior Design Program at the University of Minnesota. I'm here to support the Interior Design Practice Act and to testify that interior design education, experience, and examination prepare interior designers to fully protect the health, safety, welfare of the public, your consumers. As you know, currently, only the title Certified Interior Design is regulated. The practice of Certified Interior Design is not regulated. Anyone can practice interior design, as Senator Higgins so quickly noted, and they do. This bill, however, is about the need to protect consumers by regulating the practice of licensed interior design. I'll now provide you with some information about that education, experience, and examination. In education, interior designers are educated to prevent harm through their required specialized knowledge and courses in their post-secondary curriculum. Licensed interior designers learn specialized knowledge through their education. They learn programming, identifying consumer needs, space planning, meeting building and fire codes, preventing slippage, creating accessible interiors, and specifying materials for toxin-free environments. Universities and colleges do not teach style and trend. We teach problem solving. The knowledge required today to design the interior environment is so complex that educational standards are changing at the international level, and they have been raised. The Council for Interior Design Accreditation, CEDA, has accredited higher education in interior design for over 39 years. This is in North America and in some other international countries as well, in the Persian Gulf, for example. CEDA is formerly known as FITER. You may be more familiar with that acronym. Today, CEDA's eligibility requirements state that a program must culminate in a minimum of a bachelor's degree. There are over 160 accredited programs, interior design programs, in North America. There are 4 bachelor degree interior design programs in Minnesota. 1 is CEDA accredited. The other 3 are preparing for accreditation. For example, Brown College's director, Justin Wilverding, is here as one of our supporters. The board of AELSLAGID, and I did practice that, is the agency who determines education that is equivalent to CEDA-accredited programs. Additionally, many Minnesota interior designers come from neighboring states where there are 6 CEDA-accredited programs: Iowa State, NDSU, SDSU, University of Wisconsin-Stout, Stevens Point, and Madison. Finally, graduates from other programs, 2-year programs, for example, can practice in exempt spaces or under the direct supervision of a licensed interior designer or architect. Experience. After their education, interior designers gain a minimum of 2 years of diverse experience in the workplace. This is prior to their ability or their qualification to sit for the NCIDQ exam. National Council for Interior Design qualification is NCIDQ. Interior design students frequently complete a paid internship during school as one of the curricular requirements. After graduation, as a paid entry-level interior designer, they gain this 2 years of diverse experience to be qualified to sit for the exam. And they can gain that experience in one of two ways. There is currently IDEP. Don't you just love all these acronyms? IDEP is the Interior Design Experience Program. This is a voluntary experience program that NCIDQ has developed and operates. Through this program, entry-level interior designers work under the supervision of qualified interior designers or architects. These two are paid positions. This is their entry-level position. This is not an internship. The second way they can gain this experience is simply by working as an entry-level designer under the direct supervision of an NCIDQ certificate holder, a CID, or eventually that LID, and of course the architect. In Minnesota, this diverse experience supports health, safety, and welfare expertise through that application of their knowledge. Knowledge such as the ergonomics, fire codes, material toxicity, indoor air quality, estimation and bidding, ethics, bacteria spread, sustainable design. And we do this in all sorts of spaces, these public spaces, the restaurants, the assisted care facilities, hospitals, healthcare facilities, as well as the schools your children all attend. You may hear later in this hearing that internships are required after graduation and that they are unpaid. In interior design, internships occur during school as part of the learning experience, and they are generally paid. After graduation, the interior designer goes right into the workforce for paid experience. The examination. The interior design profession has had a 2-day practice exam for 37 years that has been developed and is conducted by NCIDQ. 100% of that exam covers interior design specialized knowledge of health, safety, and welfare. NCIDQ hires professional testing agency experts who assure that the exam is valid and reliable. The exam is revised regularly by a group of 20 interior design practitioners and test experts who review the specialized knowledge that is done through a practice analysis, and I have an example of that practice analysis here for you. In North America, there are over 24,000 NCIDQ certificate holders, that is, those who have passed the exam. You may hear later that few people pass the exam and that the cost to sit for the exam is in the thousands of dollars. In Minnesota, currently there are 571 people who have passed the exam. In your packet, there is a letter from the director of NCIDQ who states that the national passage rate for the exam is 71%, and happily, it's even higher than that in Minnesota. The cost for all three sections of the exam and the application is only $880. All of these figures align very nicely with the other design professions that are regulated by the AELS-LAGID board. We anticipate that the number will increase after this statute passes because today there are more schools that prepare students for the profession and the exam, and because it will become part of the licensure requirements. So the profession of interior design has been fully engaged in the three E's, that is, the core aspects of qualification, for over 36 years. To document that interior designers' education, experience, and exam protect the public, we've also used a study that defined and documented the interior design profession's body of knowledge. And here's a copy of that study as well. This bill is a state issue, not a national issue. However, it is important to use national guidelines to measure our education, experience, and exam. We've crafted this bill to reflect the needs of the Minnesota public, Minnesota business owners, and even opposition groups. We've met with NKBA twice. I personally spoke to their board of directors each time. We've had a conference call with their national leadership. We've met at least 3 times with concerned members of AIA. We have revised bill language to meet suggestions provided by both AIA and NKBA. However, we do not tout this as compromise language. It's important to note that both of these national organizations oppose this and other practice regulation. We're certain this bill will not affect organization members in Minnesota. Minnesota's bill is different than many other states. Finally, to summarize some of the key points, only the practice of licensed interior design will be regulated, and that scope of practice is defined in the statute and was very well given as an example by Janice Linster. People will still be able to practice interior design and call themselves interior designers. This bill will not put anyone out of work. If not licensed, not qualified to be licensed, interior designers will be able to practice in exempt spaces or in commercial spaces under the direct supervision of a licensed interior designer or architect. Architects are exempt. Architectural practice will not change, as noted by Bill Hickey and one of our other testifiers. Kitchen and bath interior designers can still practice residential design and kitchen and bath design. In your handouts, there is a statement about our belief about their ability to practice because these are in exempt spaces. The bill will have no effect on existing statutes or state building codes, and no way will the rulemaking authority change the exemptions. Exemptions are developed to protect homeowners and small business owners. They include single and dual family residences, exempt, employee or owner of a retail business who provides consultation as part of a retail sale, exempt, people who sell interior products and materials, exempt, assembly spaces under 1,000 square feet, exempt, businesses under 2,250 square feet, exempt, factories under 3,000 square feet, exempt, and mercantile spaces under 1,500 square feet, also exempt. Students who graduate without a bachelor's degree can still practice residential interior design or commercial interior design under the direct supervision of that licensed interior designer or architect. It's an important, timely issue. We need to protect the public by providing qualified licensed interior designers. Minnesota needs to be one of the leaders across the country. Thank you very much.
Dr. Guerin, I had a question, and then you said something about, you were talking about those exempt spaces, the different square footages and the different uses. I don't see that exactly in here. Is that someplace
else? That's in the statute and in the rules as well.
Probably in the rules, right, currently, right, overs that deal with certified interior designers?
It also conforms to the state building code.
Okay.
Thank you.
And my question, then, Dr. Guerin, the one that I had before before you just said that last part, was I'm looking at what statute talks about the practice of architecture and the practice of, and then the language in the bill, Senator Higgins' bill about the practice of licensed interior design. And it looks like everything in the interior design is limited to the interior.
That's right.
And non-load-bearing construction.
That's right.
What kind of work would a licensed interior designer do that only architects do now? Is there something
that only architects do know? Because we would not be working in the architecture domain. Generally, as that states, we are working only with non-load. If there are any walls involved, they're non-load-bearing walls. Certainly, an architect can work in that area as well. There is overlap. There certainly is overlap among these two professions, just as there's overlap among engineering and architecture, landscape architecture and architecture, and interior design, licensed interior design, and interior decoration.
Then my other question is that by training, does an interior designer today know what's a load-bearing wall and what isn't?
Depending on the rules that get made in the Public Rulemaking Committee, and assuming that it's going to be a CETA-accredited education or equivalent, yes, okay. Without doubt.
Oh, yes, I wanted to, the time, I thought you were talking about page one.
So the next,
we need to move on. Thank you very much. We have about 15 minutes for the proponents, if they would. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself.
My name is Tom Fisher. I'm the Dean of the College of Design at the University of Minnesota. I also sit on the AIA Minnesota board, and I teach in the School of Architecture. Our college has both a program in interior design as well as obviously a program in architecture in our School of Architecture. And given my position, I remain officially neutral on this question. I leave that up to you to decide. However, I do think it's indisputable that there are health, safety, and welfare issues involved in interior design. Factually, the greatest number of people who die in buildings die through smoke inhalation, which is related to finishes, fabrics, and furniture, as well as tripping hazards is the greatest cause of injury in buildings, also related to finishes and surfaces and what have you. But I came to mainly talk about the differences in the education of these two fields. We've had both an architecture and an interior design program at the University of Minnesota for over 30 years. They're very different in the educational format. One way to think about it is architectural education is very much like a general practitioner's education in medicine. Architects have to know everything from the interiors up to buildings, engineering, to urban planning. And they know a great deal of breadth, although in architectural education rarely get to nearly the kind of depth that our interior design program gets to, which is a much more of a specialized education, where the students tend to be more research-oriented, at least at the University of Minnesota. And when you look at the final work of our students, our architectural students come up with projects at the end that cover a wide range of issues but aren't nearly as detailed. The interior design students, their final project includes contract documents, specifications, and all of the details worked out. So it gives you a sense, in comparing these two forms of education, they're complementary, but they're different. And for that reason, they're separate programs in our college. And I think just from the perspective of a college like ours and deans such as myself around the country, but certainly also large firms that have both of these fields, I think we would love this issue to get resolved in a way that does not continue to put these two disciplines at odds. One of the issues we talk a great deal about in education is integrated practice. Increasingly, these two fields are working together in a very integrated way, and the licensure issue makes that difficult. So however it gets resolved, we would love to see it resolved in some fair-minded and equitable way.
Dean, forgive me here. A question comes to mind. They're working together now in many firms, right?
Right.
They have an architect and a certified interior designer, or they may not be certified. I don't know. But they're working together now. What will change if the interior designers are licensed? What changes then? That's what I'm missing that.
Well, probably others in practice could speak more to that. I don't think it will change the educational issues so much, although one of the things that is true is that there are FIDER, or now called CEDA, accredited programs, and then there are those that are not. Ours is a fully accredited program. I think that it may distinguish the four-year and master's and doctorate degree programs from, say, two-year programs in community colleges. So there may be a distinction in terms of accredited and non-accredited interior design programs as a result of that. But I don't think it will change this different relationship of a kind of a general practitioner education, which is traditionally true of architecture, and a much more focused, specialized education in interior design.
Okay. Right. Sir, welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is David Lair. I'm an architect, and I strongly support the In Practice Act for Interior Design. I design commercial projects. I'm a licensed architect in Minnesota, as well as 29 other states, and I'm a member of the American Institute of Architects, the AIA. I'm a co-founder and co-owner of a design firm that does architecture, interior design, and urban planning. Our business is located in downtown Minneapolis, and my business partner is a certified interior designer. The Minnesota Practice Act for Interior Design will not take away jobs from architects. Most architectural firms already use interior designers that focus on the specialized requirements of interior public spaces. The practice of architecture will not change. With this legislation, design firms who do their best work for Minnesotans will now have the ability to have licensed interior designers as part of the broader quality offering for our consumers. Interior designers have a unique body of knowledge that is different from architects. Interior designers, through their education, examination, and experience, have time and time again impressed me with their thoroughness and thoughtfulness as we collaborate on projects together. Interior designers have saved our clients money by skillfully programming spaces that are efficient, that accommodate the flows of people, and offer inspirational spaces to live and work. I have seen the impact that a qualified interior designer has on helping businesses retain and attract employees as a result of well-designed spaces. Interior designers focus on healthy environments and indoor air quality. Interior designers are leaders in sustainable design, improving the quality of lives today and keeping those opportunities alive for generations to come. On average, 90% of Minnesota's daily lives are spent indoors. This is where interior designers concentrate their careers. It only seems logical that the care and concern that interior designers have for the public's health, safety, and welfare is regulated through licensure. As an architect, I'm involved in many aspects of building design. I rely on a host of experts, mechanical engineers to help integrate heating, cooling, and plumbing, electrical engineers to help design power and technology, and interior designers to focus on the quality and performance of the interior spaces. We all collaborate together, and we integrate complex systems into a single project. This multidiscipline approach requires lots of overlap with each of these professions. On commercial projects, these multidiscipline teams almost always include architects, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, structural engineers, landscape architects, and interior designers. All of these, with the exception of interior designers, are licensed professions. More than 50% of the construction value of a new project is attributed to the interior design systems. I expect interior designers to be fully responsible for their own work. This Practice Act is important for Minnesota because it places full responsibility on interior designers for health, safety, and welfare issues for the interior design of commercial space. It requires interior designers to take full responsibility for their work in the best interest of the public. Thank you for your support of this legislation.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Then we'll have, thank you very much. Senator Higgins, I think there are maybe four more people I have on the list here. So if we could really limit your comments here. Yep. We've got
my wife. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for letting me have a voice. My name is Pamela Enns. I have a BS in interior design. I am a residential interior designer. Additionally, I am the former president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, NARI. I served as the Minnesota chapter president of the National Association of the National Kitchen and Bath Association, NKBA, in 2008. I have consistently served on professional committees to enhance the public perception that an interior design professional protects the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Residential interior designers can specialize in many different ways. We can design entire homes. We can choose to specialize in kitchens and bathrooms. We can even design home offices. This bill will not change or limit my practice. My clients won't have to pay any more for my services. I can even continue to call myself an interior designer. I strongly support this bill. Thank you.
Ms. N, thank you. I have a question. You wouldn't need a license to do what you do now.
Absolutely
would you,
not.
Would you get the license? Do you think that you would?
I definitely would. I want to express to my clients that I have the education, the experience, and the examination ability to look after their welfare, their safety, and their health in their homes. That's my choice. But it is not going to be regulated. That's just going to be my choice.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Ms. Sands, Why do you need to be licensed then? I mean, if you do the same thing that you do being certified and you're not requiring any further steps to become licensed, what is the purpose of the license? I mean, doesn't the credentialing that you have already, the certification, indicate that you're capable and proficient in all of these areas already?
It does. Indeed, it does. But in order for myself to stand out, given that I have taken the time for the examination and for the experience and for the education, I want my clients to know that I've got that. And I also want to be a leader in my community as a professional interior designer. So it's really more from a personal point of view that I'm doing this, not that I will require it after this bill is passed. But I do totally believe in the profession of interior design. I went into interior design because I had twin babies, and we were exempt from entering spaces because at that time we didn't have ADA. There were restaurants we couldn't get into. There were public spaces I couldn't get into. And I wanted to make a difference, and I wanted to make a difference in a personal space. And I continue to have that passion.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Ms. Enns, I'm still having a hard time understanding what the difference is between the certification and the licensing, since there are no different criteria, no different education. Now, nothing's different except changing it from certified to licensed.
Could I pass that question on to one of my people?
Oh, sure. We can have somebody.
Have people.
You have people. Welcome, and please just identify yourself.
Certainly. I'm Dr. Karen Martin, and the response to that question, Madam Chair and members of the committee, is that certification is voluntary. Certification is voluntary, and it has nothing to do with the practice of interior design. So today, Ms. Enns can call herself a certified interior designer, and she can practice interior design, but so can probably anyone in this room, including our esteemed committee.
Is it the taking the test pretty much that makes the difference?
The difference is that the spaces that Ms. Enns referred to are exempt in this bill, and they will not be addressed by this licensing bill. Should a residential designer, someone practicing in exempt spaces in Minnesota, choose, as Ms. Enns obviously plans on doing, to become a licensed interior designer, if she has the qualifications, she can do that. But public spaces in Minnesota need to have the protection of a licensed interior designer. And right now, we don't have that. Anyone can design the interior of buildings because the current law is a title act. It just protects the title, certified interior designer.
I think we're wondering, maybe, I don't know if this is, we're wondering how one becomes certified. Maybe that would help.
Title Act.
Yes, certainly, Madam Chair, I would be happy to do that. Presently, I just completed my 8 years on the AELS LAGID board. And what we do when we review files as a certified interior design member, I would review files to see if someone had proper education, CETA or FITER accredited or equal as determined by the board. I would also look for the proper experience in 7 of 11 types of experience that are prescribed in the current rules. And if that was there, also look for passage of the NCIDQ examination, a signature on a code of conduct, and I believe that's it. And then the person could become certified.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
So, Ms. Martin, what would you do differently to determine if a person would be licensed?
Ms. Martin.
Thank you for the question. Basically, the person would end up doing what was required as it comes out of the public rulemaking committee, because the things that I just described are contained within the rulemaking process, which is overseen by the Minnesota Board of AALS LAGID.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
So Then, Madam Chair, my next question is Senator Higgins, because she said there was no cost to this bill. So if there is rulemaking and if there is a licensing board, how would there not be cost to the bill?
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you for the question. And I would like to defer this question to the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of AELS-LAGID, Doreen Frost, who is here, so I would gladly give up my seat.
Gladly.
Did you have more testimony than Ms. Martin later?
Yes.
Okay, we only really have like about 2 minutes here, so let's...
I only want one.
Okay.
The
Ms.
question,
Frost, welcome. Just identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Doreen Frost, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. The certified interior... That was part of the requirements for the job. Certified interior designers are currently on our board, and certified interior designers can have that as a standalone certificate, and also there are architects that currently have their architecture license as well as a CID title. There is a fee for that. If the rulemaking does go through and or the grandparenting reopens, there will be a cost to the board. It is my understanding that that cost will be borne by the applicants that are interested in applying for it. This is no different than when the geoscience came on board in 1996 and the legislative arena gave the licensing board a one-time appropriation to open up the grandparenting and to go forth with the rule writing.
Grandparenting, Ms. Frost, meaning bringing everybody who's currently doing that into?
If you change from a practice act to a title act or put in a new licensure program, they have opened up to the grandparenting to anybody who's currently a certified interior designer or holds a dual license.
Is that just automatic, Ms. Frost?
It's what the legislative arena has done for as long as I've known anyway.
Okay. So that means that everybody who's got that CID classification would automatically qualify for licensure, Ms. Frost.
That's how the legislative arena has handled it in the past, Senator Schein.
Are we the arena?
Yes.
Okay. I just wasn't sure.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Desiree Slewinski. I am currently enrolled as a junior in a Bachelor's of Science Interior Design program. This semester, I am studying commercial office design. In class, we learn to address client goals of increasing employee productivity and retaining staff. The research we conduct enhances our ability to problem solve. The scope of this project includes developing space plans that support multi-generational communication, code compliance, lighting design, disability access, health issues from items like formaldehyde used in cubicle furnishings, and control of glare from daylighting. Licensed interior designers will be knowledgeable in these and many other areas to make responsible and educated decisions that affect the health, safety, and welfare of the people using the space. And ultimately, this directly influences the employer's bottom line. It is a cost savings to the employer to do this right the first time. I'm here today because this bill is crucial in improving our economy and in drastically transforming people's lives by preventing harm. Having licensed interior design practice will also provide me with more employment opportunities and opportunities through growth throughout my life. Your yes vote today ensures that change for the greater public good. I thank you in advance for validating my education and protecting the consumers. Thank you.
Ms. Slewinski, thank you. Best wishes on your education here. And are you Ms. Marsh?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Thank
Welcome.
You. Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rochelle Marish. I am an interior designer from Minneapolis, hold a Bachelor of Science in Interior Design, have passed the NCIDQ, and am a certified interior designer. I've been practicing interior design for 13 years, specializing in corporate office design since 2000 and hospital and medical facilities since 2003. Hospital and medical facilities are one of the most complex areas of design and planning. You may already have an idea about what an interior designer already does. Let me explain to you how interior designers do more than just pick out colors. We positively impact the health, safety, and welfare of a building. Now think of the last time you were visiting a healthcare facility, whether it was visiting a loved one in a hospital, a nursing home, or going to a clinic. Now imagine you're visiting this loved one. You walk into the front entrance, walk down a couple of corridors, and go into their room. You sit down next to your loved one, noticing the space around you, the colors, the smells, the soft lighting. You feel safe because you know that the hospital floor was easy to navigate, that the corridors are clear in case of an emergency, because you can see the nurse's station, you're confident that your loved one will be taken care of, and that the materials and finishes are not off-gassing toxins for you and your loved one. This is how you know that you are safe. All of this is ensured because a qualified interior designer worked on this project. Now imagine something goes wrong, the fire alarm goes off. Not a good feeling anymore. But if I have done my job, you and your loved one will get out safely. Because in this drawing set, I have not only specified the materials and furnishings that make you feel good, I have determined wayfinding strategies, including floor patterns, color cues, and easily seen exit signs. As an interior designer, I've programmed visual cues to get you and the visually impaired out of the space. For the disabled, I have specified handrails on the wall so that you can find your way to the door, and the doors are labeled in Braille so that you know that it's an exit. I have reviewed the plans for traffic patterns and the nurse station for functionality and ergonomics, reviewed the durability, flammability, and infection control of all materials and finishes specified, the lighting for the energy efficiency, and many other sustainable design strategies. Now, many of these may be code, but many, many more are part of the design process. This is all ensured because a qualified interior designer worked on this project. These are the health, safety, and welfare aspects of interior design. Now, anyone can print on their business cards tomorrow and claim to be an interior designer because they are something I hear all the time, good with colors. This is only a small percentage of what we do. Well-designed spaces do not happen by accident, nor do they magically appear because someone can blend color and materials. It takes education, examination, and experience to ensure a level of competence for public spaces. Licensure ensures that interior designers have this education, examination, and experience. Perhaps it's time to ask the public, what is the environment in which you want your family to live, to learn, or to be cared for? And how do you know that it was designed correctly? How do you ensure the best for your loved ones? Rely on qualified, licensed interior designers. Thank you.
Ms. Marish, thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Marish, how long have you been designing for your hospitals?
I have been working specifically within the healthcare realm since 2003.
Ms. Marish, your reputation and referral network has provided you that business, correct?
Actually, Marish. I work at a firm mm-hmm. located within, I work at an architecture firm.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
So, Ms. Marish, though, they wouldn't continually give you this work unless you had a really good reputation of doing it right.
Ms. Marish.
I think that question, if I may understand what you're specifically stating. Do you mind explaining yourself just a little bit more with your question?
Ms. Marish, it's not a... Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Marish, it's not a question. You're very successfully working in your field. I'm just making a statement.
I would agree that I would say that I am a... I have been working in the field for 13 years.
And I think, Senator Johnson, maybe you're getting at... What will be the difference in the quality of your work if you're licensed versus where you are now? Is that kind
Madam
of
Chair,
point,
no,
Senator
I'm
Johnson?
Just kind of throwing up the idea that what you said is true, but also the fact that she's working successfully, she's got a reputation of what she does. People aren't going to take someone out of a two-year program to do the type of work she's doing. It's her own reputation and her own work ethic that have gotten to her to where she is.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Now, Ms. Martin, want to come back here? We're really out of time, but we'll try to. We've asked questions, so that's...
Thank you.
That shortened your time. Thank you. Ms. Martin, welcome back to the table.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Martin. I'm assistant professor in the College of Design at the University of Minnesota. I practiced professional interior design for over 17 years before going to the academy. For the past 14 years, my research and scholarship has focused on the development of interior design as a profession and the interior design profession's body of knowledge, and I'm a known expert on these topics. today I'm going to skip a lot of what I was going to say due to time, and my students and my husband would be amazed that I'm going to cut myself short.
And we won't know the difference.
Yes. One thing I'd like to point out to you, that in the melee of what's going on today, you're probably going to hear from the Institute for Justice, and since 2006 they've produced four reports that address interior design and how it's trying to exclude people from practice. What I will tell you today is that no one will be excluded from practice, because the people that are identified in their report are people that are exempt from the licensed interior design bill for the state of Minnesota. And unfortunately, they use data that commingles interior decoration, floral design, ceramic design, product design, and interior design. And so that's a problem. And it's really important to realize that the people that are the basis of a lot of what you're going to hear about are exempt from this bill because they design in exempt spaces. Single and dual family homes, kitchens and baths and residential facilities, these are exempt. Minnesota does value professions. There are approximately 94 professions licensed in the state of Minnesota, and licensing has an inverse relationship to the growth and then diminishment of unions in the United States as we move from a blue-collar to a white-collar economy. Certainly, there's no profession, licensed profession in Minnesota that we would not want to have more minorities and people with greater levels of education and see more minority students in those degrees. Interior design is no exception. We, unfortunately, are working in that regard. With this bill, there are checks and balances that exist with a license in terms of the licensing board itself and the FTC. And it's important to remember that many opportunities exist to persons beyond the licensed interior designer, such as interior designer, interior decorator, decorator designer, or design consultant. These are all fields that will still be able to be practiced and titles that will still be able to be used. The important point about licensure is that it will enable the public to determine which individuals are qualified in the design of interior spaces. People who have really excellent reputations, such as Ms. Marish, earn that reputation because she has been through the experience, the exam, and the education, not in that order. Some will tell you that the public is protected because as consumers, they can complain. However, the data do not support that belief. And in fact, repeatedly, studies have found that consumers will not complain. And I would also ask the committee to consider if complaining or civil suits after the fact, after someone slips and falls and breaks a hip, or after a respiratory complication of a child, if that's the time to prevent harm. Because that's what some people would lead you to believe is the appropriate way to go. Licensure is purposefully intended to identify a high level of professional expertise as determined through formal education, monitored experience, and a psychometrically valid exam. Licensure is necessary to make sure Minnesota citizens are protected in public spaces such as schools and nursing homes. Thank you.
Dr. Martin, Senator Olson has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Martin, thank you for your testimony. I'm not sure if you would be the best person to answer this or anyone else who's testified. But I guess just because I'm a lawyer, I think about the legal aspect of it. And we've talked a lot about public safety concerns. So that makes me wonder, you know, how this works from a liability standpoint. Is it anticipated that if there's a licensure that there would be additional liability insurance or bonding requirements? I mean, how is that working now? I guess I assumed that the architect was ultimately responsible for signing off on code requirements and things that would relate to, that would be more likely to lead to liability if they weren't done correctly. So would you be potentially, I mean, are you getting sued now for those kinds of liability things, or would you be expanding your liability if this were adopted?
Dr. Martin, do you want to try to answer that? Or?
Thank you, Senator Olson. And I'd like to defer that question to Janice Linster, if I may, because she can speak directly to it.
Ms. Linster, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I can speak from two sides. I think owning an own business and a practice where we do that work already, we are liable for the work that we perform. We have insurance. Again, we're really not we're not changing the rule for those of us who practice this full scope of service. What we're really trying to say is that we're trying to distinguish between those who have the ability to do this work and those who don't. So there is a liability in our business, and certainly if I specified a flooring material and someone and it was a wrong specification slipped on that, I would be liable today and would be in the future as well.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Linster, but I'm thinking specifically more along the lines of safety and code requirements and those kinds of things. I mean, if you have usually does the firm have to show proof of liability insurance? Is it the architect that does that? Is there usually a bonding requirement? I guess I'm just wondering I would have thought that was more under the architect, and I'm wondering if this would be changing that at all.
Yep. Ms. Linster.
Thank you. As a firm, we are insured and currently are insured for the type of work that we do. We are insured for practicing interior design in spaces. So our insurance would be different if we were practicing architecture. We're practicing a category of providing interior design services. So our insurance, the cost to us would not change because we are still providing that service. I still would perform the same services. I definitely pay insurance, and it is in relation to the type of work that we perform. Now, having said that, when we work in certain working for the state, the universities, they have minimal requirements set that might be higher than my field might dictate. And if I want to work for them, I need to pay that insurance amount. But we currently pay insurance based on the scope of work that we provide. It is based on an interior design scope of work, not an engineering or an architectural scope of work of services. And that would continue to be the case. I am liable.
Thank you very much. And now we have probably roughly an hour or so, and I think maybe we might have questions from members or not, and if the opponents want to take about at least 45 minutes here, that would be about what we just did. So I am showing Lee McGrath, and maybe a couple of you want to come up, and Ann Voda.
Good to see you.
Come on up and
thank you.
Sit at the table. Did you want somebody else with you at the same time?
She can come when he leaves.
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I thank the members of the committee. My name is Lee McGrath, and thank you for the opportunity to testify against Senate File 376. I am the executive director of the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is a public interest law firm. We participated in the challenge to a similar licensing law in Alabama, which the state Supreme Court ruled was unconstitutional. We've successfully sued the state of New Mexico over its titling law, and we're currently suing the states of Texas, Oklahoma, Connecticut on behalf of interior designers after those states enacted bills that are far less oppressive and arbitrary than what is being proposed here. I urge the committee to reject this bill for four reasons. First, and with all due respect to my friend Senator Higgins, it has nothing to do with health and safety and everything to do with fencing. Second, any claim about protecting health and safety is undermined by the bill's numerous exemptions. Third, it reduces jobs and consumer choices, and it increases prices paid by customers. And fourth, it is likely unconstitutional. Members have in their packet my complete testimony. I'll focus my remarks on just a couple of those points today. First, proponents repeatedly claim that the bill is necessary to protect the public health and safety. This is pure pretext for reducing competition and increasing prices to customers, and is unsubstantiated by any research. Proponents have not produced a single study or analysis showing that requiring interior designers to become licensed, as they have in Florida, Louisiana, Nevada, and the District of Columbia, has led to fewer fires, fewer building collapses, greater consumer protection, more green construction, better air quality. There is just no connection between licensure and consumer and health and safety.
Mr. McGrath, if I might, Senator Vandeveer, did you have a question?
I do, Madam Chair. Mr. McGrath.
Yes.
You kind of said two different things in the same sentence. You said it's not about health and safety because of the numerous exemptions, and then you said it's about fencing. So if the numerous exemptions, how can it be about fencing if it's about, if it has so many exemptions? It wouldn't, it doesn't, you're not making sense.
let me try to be clearer then.
The chair would urge you to do more.
Madam Chairman, Senator Vandeveer, it is about fencing because, one, it fences out people going who want to perform interior design in commercial spaces. It is irrational because if you were really concerned about health and safety, you wouldn't put in all those exemptions. What the bill does, it exempts in areas that potentially offer much greater risk. What it exempts is for the most sophisticated buyers, commercial construction companies.
Madam Chair,
Senator Vandeveer.
Mr. McGrath, what it exempts is what is traditionally exempted from a lot of areas of licensing, and that is the residential, the single family. And I mean, that's been an area that people are allowed to practice in without, for example, to do contracting and painting and things like that that you can't do in commercial, and you have to be licensed. So the exemption is actually quite traditional. It's not something that's odd or unique, just for your information.
Well, thank you, Senator.
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, it might be historical in nature. However, it does suggest that the bill is irrational and arbitrary. It exempts, not only does it exempt in residential spaces, it also exempts retailers. For example, Senator Vandeveer, a 17-year-old working at Menards is exempted, but the bill requires that a woman with an eye toward office design with 20 years of on-the-job training, she has to go back to school and pass an exam if she wants to consult on paint and wall coverings in office buildings. So the exemptions are greater than just on residential and suggests that the bill is arbitrary.
Senator Vandeveer.
Now, Madam Chair, I don't like to. It's not my bill, but it doesn't do what you're saying it does. The reason those people, as I understand it, can continue to do what they're doing exactly the way they're doing it under an architect. If I understand, is that correct? Yeah. So you're. I know I can't say you don't make sense, but you're saying that the bill, what you're saying about the bill isn't the bill. It doesn't.
He's drawing it maybe a different conclusion from it than you are, Senator Vandeveer, I guess.
Madam Chair, I think you can draw a different conclusion, but when you're just factually in error, you're in error.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Senator Vandeveer, there's more exemptions in this besides residential. That's what he's referring to. There's a list of exemptions besides residential. I think that's what he's referring to.
They are.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. McGrath, yes.
Madam Chairman, Senator Johnson, you're absolutely right. This bill is riddled with exemptions, and every exemption that is in the bill undermines its claim that its goal is to protect the public's health and safety. There are whole swaths of the public that are not protected, but instead are exempted from this bill. Now, that might make sense as a legislative strategy to get the bill enacted, senators, but it doesn't make sense in terms of a candid commitment to protecting the public's health and safety. Finally, Madam Chair, Senator, this bill is, if enacted, is likely to be found unconstitutional for the very reasons that the state of Alabama declared the law unconstitutional. It is arbitrary. It is riddled with exemptions. And unfortunately, what proponents of this legislation are in essence saying is that interior designers in Minnesota should be less free, and construction companies should have less freedom than those working in Alabama. This is not true, and the case serves as an important precedent to suggest that there should be great reservations about enacting this legislation.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. McGrath. Do you know whether there are people today who are working, doing this type of design for commercial projects and would not be working under architects? So are there people who would be prohibited from doing the jobs they're doing today? I don't know if there are any of those people here, if we'll be hearing from them. Because one of my big concerns in today's environment is that we're not doing anything to impact jobs, have a negative impact on jobs. But maybe the way that this practice is done, we're really not impacting them. I don't know. I guess that's my question.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, your question is a very good one. Yes, I do know of people who are currently working for commercial construction companies who do not currently work under architects and who do provide interior designers. More than my anecdotes, however, Kenyon College professors Harrington and Treber have just released a study which shows that on average these types of licensing laws reduce the number of practitioners by about 1,300 in every state where they have enacted. And additionally, they cause costs to go up by about $7 million for every municipality or state of 1 million people. So, in essence, the potential here in Minnesota of this type of cost, according to Harrington and Treber, approaches $35 million. Okay. And the reason they do is for the very reason, Senator Olson, that you raise, which is that licensing laws restrict entry into a field, they reduce competition, and they cause prices to go higher.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McGrath.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
Voda, Chair. Senator Higgins?
If I may, the discussion about exemptions. The exemptions that are listed in this bill are the same exemptions that are currently in statute for all of those people under the AELSLAGID board, the architects, the engineers, the land surveyors, the land architects, and landscape architects, and so on. That list of exemptions is exactly the same.
It's partly true. That statute.
Senator Higgins, is that statutory? I'm looking at the statute, and I see it. I'm sorry. I see the exceptions. Right.
But the devices, stuff like the
Madam Chair.
Establishments and
the okay, the retail. Some of
those aren't in there.
Okay, the retail establishment part and
farm
and the farms are not okay.
Clause 4R. 4R.
Okay. Yeah. So I see in 326. Those exceptions appear. There are four of them: dwellings, single-family, two-family dwellings, farm building, and temporary buildings or sheds.
And retail.
So, pardon me?
And retail.
Do you see retail?
No, those are not in there.
Yeah, right. They're not. Yeah. So the ones I just named are in there. Okay, Mr. McGrath, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Van Buren.
If I could, one more question. So your main point seems to be that licensing is fencing, so We should then repeal the license on real estate agents, appraisers, doctors, landscape architects, or the surveyors. All of this is fencing. You've made a pretty generic statement. Is that your belief then? Or?
Mr. McGrath, Madam briefly Chair, on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, you had the good fortune to, last week of hearing the testimony of Professor Morris Kleiner from the University of Minnesota. And what his research has shown is that any markets that the government can convey the market signals about quality through certification. It does not need licensure. And what his research has also shown is that licensure reduces the number, creates barriers to entry. It reduces the supply of labor. And when you reduce the supply of something, its price goes up. The reason why trade associations advocate for licensing is and appear in front of this and other committees is to advance the interests of their members to have fewer competitors. That is what licensure does.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Ms. Voda, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Voda. I'm a licensed architect and president of Benz Thompson Reto Architects in Minneapolis. Today, Sandy and I speak for the AIA Minnesota as well.
My name is Sandy Gay, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And I am a licensed architect, though I would call myself an architect in transition as I lost my job in November.
Thank you.
So currently I am not working and we're not here about jobs, but I just throw that out.
But I see you are also a certified interior designer. It looks like on my, is that correct?
That is correct. And my background is that I have an undergraduate degree, 4-year degree in interior design. I went back to school and got a master's degree in architecture. And since that time, I've practiced both interior design and architecture. Most recently, I was employed by Lifetime Fitness and was one of the people laid off in November when they cut back on their growth pattern. We'd just like to emphasize that AIA Minnesota does not favor this bill. And Ann Voda will speak first.
Ms. Voda. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The state of Minnesota, presently license architects to protect the health, safety, and welfare of occupants inside a building. To earn that license, we meet requirements of accredited education, training, and exam. And here in Minnesota, that means a 4-year bachelor's degree and a 3-year master's of architecture degree. It also means a rigorous and well-documented intern development program or on-the-job training under the supervision of a licensed architect. And in my day, this was a 3-year commitment, but now it takes our interns 4.5 years to complete that on-the-job training due to the fact that they have to gain experience in every category of practice. And then finally, we must pass a 7-part, 33-hour comprehensive exam, also covering the complex categories of practice. These exams can take another 2 years to schedule and successfully complete. We feel the state is justified in these requirements of us because the practice of architecture is complex, and to protect the occupants of the buildings we design, we are responsible for a comprehensive coordination of numerous specialties to make the building work as a whole. This includes some licensed and some unlicensed specialties, including engineers, acousticians, lighting designers, and interior designers, among many other specialties. Our responsibility does not stop just inside the exterior walls. When we locate an exit door, we also design the exit path within. When we locate a fresh air intake at the exterior, we must route it throughout the building, get it to the fan, and then distribute it back out to the occupants, the healthy fresh air to the occupants of the building. When an existing building is remodeled and the partitions are moved
and the use of the space changes, you require an architect to take responsibility for that work right now. It's not unusual for the code review in those circumstances to reveal that the work to bring the building up to current health, safety, and welfare standards reaches well beyond the immediate interiors project. You rightly require that a licensed architect take responsibility for those interior projects to protect the occupants when the work is done. We believe this bill allows a shortcut to the practice of architecture. It will allow interior designers to take responsibility for the comprehensive coordination of architectural systems, which allow the building to function as a whole, without the credentials or training to do so. Reducing, in fact, the protections that you have put into place to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the occupants. If you compare the definition of the practice of interior design in this bill with the practice of architecture defined in the statute, it's not shown in the piece you have here, but if you look at the way they define interior design practice with the way we define architecture practice, there are very few words edited. It primarily has to do with the structural elements of load-bearing partitions. In 1992, the AIA compromised with the interior designers and agreed on the Title Act to distinguish interior designers who meet additional requirements of education, training, and exam. These interior designers may use the title Certified Interior Designer, or CID, to indicate this additional training. Some architects, due to our practice or our interests, also credential ourselves with the title CID. This count is from last year, but of approximately 740 CIDs in Minnesota, 80% of them are also licensed architects. Approximately 20% are interior designers, or there are approximately 150 interior designers who are CIDs who would be affected by this bill. There's been a point of confusion about the practice of commercial interior design. Presently, interior designers in commercial buildings, to the extent that they are practicing legally, must do so under the supervision of a licensed architect. The building code requires it. The authorities having jurisdiction enforce this requirement, especially in the cities, but they do have latitude. And the title of Certified Interior Designer is already a point of confusion for many. If approved, this bill will exacerbate this confusion of practice overlap. It will require additional bureaucracy, which will not produce value for the cost, and which in fact diminishes protection to the public. Lastly, there's no evidence to suggest harm to the public is occurring as a result of this unregulated practice of interior design.
Ms. Gay, were you going to speak then also?
Yes, I just have a conclusion here, and
yes,
I'll make
please.
It short. Minnesota law requires four factors to be considered for regulation of an occupation: whether the unregulated practice may harm or endanger the public, whether the practice requires special skill, whether the public may be effectively protected by other means, and whether the overall cost-effectiveness of regulation would be positive for the citizens of Minnesota. AIA Minnesota believes that proper consideration of these factors does not justify the licensing of interior designers. We do not argue that interior designers have skill. In fact, we rely on it when we formulate a design team. We do insist, however, that the other three criteria for licensing are not met. The cost of such licensing would produce no additional value for the citizens. In fact, will reduce their protections from current law. The unregulated practice of interior design has not endangered the public, and the public is already protected by your existing law, which requires a licensed architect to take responsibility for the health, safety, and welfare of the occupants and buildings. Thank you very much.
I have a question, if I might, of either of you. Today, if there's the reconfiguration of an office space, for example, does that require an architect to sign off? Let's say that we're not doing load-bearing walls or anything. What's required today?
If you need a building permit to do the work, you probably are required to have a professional licensed architect sign on the drawings.
There are also other health, safety, welfare issues that we address other than load-bearing walls.
Sure. No, I understand that. I just...
And that isn't the threshold that determines whether the idea that the load-bearing walls is a threshold that exempts a project from having a licensed architect. That's not a it's not the only concern.
Right. I just used it as an example because it's the one thing that's yes. In looking at the bill, it says that a licensed interior designer could prepare documents relative to non-load-bearing interior construction space, you know, that sort of thing. So it's somewhat different. I mean, it makes a point that it's interior spaces, but I don't know what the difference would be for an architect. I mean, I see the architecture practice, and that has to do with structures and utilities and those things that conform to specifications and design. I don't. Well, I guess they have the same thing, only of the interior spaces. It's hard to get our head around this. Maybe you can tell. Senator Johnson and then Olson.
Madam Chair, along your line of thinking, I'm just concerned that maybe there will be a way around the architectural involvement then.
You mean if interior designers are licensed?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think so. Did somebody...
That's our concern.
I thought one of you suggested that. So I don't know.
If I may,
Ms. Voda.
Presently, in the interior of a building, if it's being remodeled, this is the area of practice that we're worried about removing the responsibility of the architect. Because the practice of architecture does involve all these architectural systems, there would be an occasion in interior projects where the architect could be removed from being responsible if the interior license professional took that role.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just trying to get a good feel for this, too, I think, because we're not all as familiar with how the practice works in this area, or at least I'm not. I'm not exactly sure where the lines are drawn. So my question is, when it comes to public safety, because that seems to be the basis that the designers are asking to be licensed under, and as you said, kind of it's a requirement generally if we're going to license something. As things stand today, is it generally those public safety issues?
I don't know.
Are those generally the responsibility of the architect? Or could you think of some areas where the designers would be responsible for those public safety concerns now and you wouldn't be? And you know, or is it always ultimately the buck stops with the architect and, right. and you're the ones who end up being sued or having to post a bond for those issues?
In one of our recent...
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Okay. In one of our recent meetings with the interior designers, that was the question we posed. Where is the practice of interior design distinct from the practice of architecture where it would warrant licensing, where the health, safety, and welfare aspects were an issue? We don't know the answer to that.
Senator Olson.
Okay, thank you. And then on the other side of the coin, Madam Chair and Ms. Voda and Ms. Gay, I'm wondering, are there some people, as you know how people are practicing today, who work in the area of commercial design doing aspects of their job that don't impact public safety, where we might be precluding them if we required this licensure for no, you know, for a reason that wouldn't make sense? I mean, are there some people who are simply just helping people pick out things that have to do with aesthetics as opposed to public safety, and would they be precluded from doing what they're doing now if we license people?
Ms. Voda.
Madam Chair, I frankly don't know. I mean, we would, I guess our expertise is practicing architecture in the way we are bound to do it by the licensing laws affecting us.
Okay. Thank you. We have Ben. Mr. Nagorski? And I don't know if there was anybody else that was going to come with you.
We have a whole group of I would like to testify as to the impact, and I know you're running short on time.
Well, that's okay. I think we can still do this. We aren't going to have a whole lot of time at the end for questions, but we've been asking questions right through. So is there someone else in I don't know if Michael Palkowicz.
Yeah, he's certainly welcome to sit here.
Come on up and okay. Welcome.
Welcome, Madam Chair. Thank you very much to the members of the committee for allowing me to come from New Jersey to testify this afternoon. I'm the attorney. My name is Edward Nagorski. I'm the general counsel for the National Kitchen and Bath Association. We have 43,000 members nationwide representing all facets of the kitchen and bath industry. There are over 1,200 members of our organization here in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to ask that you oppose this regulation because it will, in fact, absolutely restrict the members of our organization as well as the vast majority of the design community from practicing a profession that they've been practicing for decades without public concern or fear. I've heard a number of people testifying today that this bill would exempt a wide range of practices, and it's really not going to put anybody out of business. It's not going to change the way that we do business at all. And I'd say, if that's the case, why would we have this law proposed at all? Clearly, the intent and purpose of this is, in fact, to restrict people from working. The requirements for certification, education, the testing, the school, are the exact same requirements under the proposed practice law. The only difference is, rather than no longer be able to call yourself a certified interior designer, you now will no longer be able to practice interior design in any commercial setting. You'll be relegated to just a small area of the design profession, single-family and two-family residential dwellings. Retailers such as Home Depot and Lowe's can provide some consultation, but certainly no design services. That would preclude any design work in condominiums, apartment buildings, assisted living facilities, anything at all other than single-family and two-family dwellings. But the exemptions that are being offered here really is not the issue that I would think the committee should focus on. The first and fundamental issue to be addressed is whether the continued unregulated practice of the interior design profession clearly, directly, and significantly endangers the public health, safety, and welfare. There's been absolutely no evidence presented, direct or otherwise, that the public is in need of protection from the many thousands of designers in Minnesota that this small group of interior designers have deemed unqualified to practice in commercial spaces. There have been 12 state studies on interior design regulation. All 12 have concluded that there's absolutely no need to regulate interior designers and that there would be no additional public benefit to doing so. States such as Washington, Washington, D.C., California, Georgia, New Mexico have all reached the same conclusion. I did hopefully submit a packet to you all previously. The most recent study, actually there are two recent studies, one from Colorado, where a title act was introduced just 2 weeks ago, did a sunrise review, examined every single jurisdiction in the state to find any instance whatsoever of public harm for the failure to unregulate interior design. They found not one instance whatsoever. In fact, in Minnesota, that was part of this study. There were a grand total since 2004 of four complaints to the board about interior designers. Not one had anything to do with health, safety, welfare. Two had to do with a failure to pay taxes. One was an architect whose license expired due to a clerical error. And the fourth was a designer whose certification expired and failed to renew it. That is it. Four since 2004. Certainly you're going to hear testimony from our members about the negative impact that this bill would have. And I know Mr. McGrath mentioned the fact that when you have any type of licensing or legislation like this, the number of designers in the state does decrease. In Minnesota, since 1993, the number of registered interior designers has decreased by more than 24% up through October. And I suspect with the economy the way it is, it may be even lower today. You've heard from a number of supporters and proponents of the bill about the need for education, experience, and the type of training they have at schools, and we don't dispute that at all. But you also heard from every single practitioner that when they do a commercial project, it is not in isolation. They are working together as a collaborative team with architects and engineers and construction code enforcement officials and fire inspectors. So there is a host of people working on a commercial project that ensures that the public health, safety, and welfare is well covered. And that's why, frankly, there are no consumer complaints about health, safety, welfare issues in the state of Minnesota. I know that I've got a lot of people wishing to testify. I know your time is short, so I'll keep my time short. However, we've heard from a lot of people. The one group you haven't heard from today and probably won't be hearing from is the public itself. The public isn't asking for this regulation. The public isn't confused as to the qualifications of designers or what their skill set is. The public has ample means to determine the qualifications of an interior designer if they wish to do so. Aside from the trade associations like the National Kitchen and Bath Association or American Society of Interior Designers or the Interior Design Society or the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, who also opposes this bill, or AIA, they all have lists and websites and marketing materials and educational materials and advertising to educate the consumer as to the different qualifications among the design professionals. Likewise, the internet. Likewise, television and print advertising. I would submit that the public today has more information available to it to decide what the qualifications are of the designers than at any other time in the past. Licensing designers today, regulating them in some fashion, is not a public health, safety, welfare issue. The reality is the public isn't concerned. The only one that would be protected from a licensing bill or with a licensing bill would be those few designers, and I think the last statistic we saw were 399 NCIDQ certificate holders that are registered in Minnesota. Those 399 would certainly receive an economic benefit by keeping the rest of the design profession out of the commercial space. Thank you.
Mr. Nagorski, thank you. Is there anybody else speaking in opposition that's come from out of town? I don't.
Yeah.
Do you want to come up to please here?
Well, no, yeah. I want
to
stay in what.
Okay.
I think you meant out of town, out of
okay.
state.
Okay.
Galen is in town.
Okay.
He's in state.
Okay.
I'd be happy to answer any questions. Again, thank you for allowing me to
thank
testify.
Thank you.
I hadn't planned to, actually.
Thank you, Mr. Nagorski. Mr. Palkowicz, is it?
Yes, Palkowicz, that's good. Thank you for allowing me to testify here. I will also try to be brief. My name is Michael J. Palkowicz. I am a graduate of St. Paul Technical Vocational College right over here in 1972. And right out of there, I went to work for a kitchen and bath design and remodeling company here in St. Paul. And I worked there for several years. And through that company, I was fortunate enough to get involved with the National Kitchen and Bath Association, and through them I received extensive training and education in the area of kitchen and bath design, among other things, how it pertained to health, safety, and welfare in the area of kitchens and baths. And I think that organization is the number one association in the country with that type of information and expertise. Being involved with them for a number of years, I became the first certified master kitchen and bath designer in the state of Minnesota. I've served as the president and most recently the VP of Government Relations for the Minnesota chapter of the National Kitchen and Bath Association, and I've now owned my own business for 14 years. Overall, I've got 37 years of experience in this field. And how this bill would directly affect me is simply that there's an exemption for two-family dwellings. However, after doing kitchen and bath design for a number of years, I was fortunate enough to expand my practice into doing display and showroom design, designing stores, designing within commercial spaces related to the kitchen and bath industry, appliance stores, for instance, people that have cabinet displays,
of kitchen kinds of cabinets
kitchen
and
kinds
or baths.
Of things. I've also designed the test kitchen for Litt Microwaves, Pillsbury, and Tupperware. So I've designed displays for Maytag, Wilson Arts, Sub-Zero, Wolf. I've done complete home value stores because my planning expertise has spilled over into those areas. Now, what you've heard is that the exemptions would be for two-family dwellings and farm outbuildings and the like, that list that you have in front of you. that would directly impact my business, and I would be forced to pare way back to where I was about 20 years ago. And to the best of my knowledge, none of the structures that I've worked on or designed have collapsed, have caused any problem to the health, safety, and welfare of the public. And that's because there's a ready in place, in my opinion, plan review, permit, and inspection procedures of all residential buildings. And when I do get involved in commercial structures, there's layers upon layers of people that look at plans, that look at the situation. There's architects and inspectors, and it's covered. I just don't see a need for this. And thank you very much.
Mr. Polkowicz, thank you. Any questions? And I think we'll just move along and have Amy Flieger, Ron Sonic, maybe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee
Welcome.
Members. Thank you. My name is Amy Flieger, and I'm an AKBD, which is an Associate Kitchen and Bath Designer, and my certificate comes through the National Kitchen and Bath Association. I am a co-owner of Stonebridge Kitchens, so I'm sitting here with my business partner, and we plan to make it short and sweet on how it would impact us. Our certification through the NKBA, we've studied many things, including spatial design, of course, but also lighting, plumbing, that would be beneficial to knowing your kitchen and bathrooms. Along with that, we studied colors and products. And being part of the National Kitchen and Bath Association and holding an AKBD, we need to do continuing education. Our goal soon is to have a CAP certification or an aging in place, which would mean that we would be able to work with baby boomers to ensure them that they could maybe live in an environment without moving to a nursing home. Our concern with this is that with this bill, it would prevent us from expanding to maybe apartments or condos, which is where a lot of these baby boomers would potentially live and reside. We would like the opportunity, especially in this economy, to be able to bid and provide and ensure the services that would be safe for these clients. So as a small business owner, I would like to just ask you to not pass this bill. Thank you.
And Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And are you a certified interior designer?
I'm an associate kitchen and bath designer.
And that so you comes wouldn't be through the Kitchen and Bath Association. That
correct.
Yeah, it's not.
It's
in
through
our
the NKBA, right?
So, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Scogin.
And Ms. Flieger, you wouldn't be grandfathered in.
Correct.
Under this. Thank you.
Madam Chairman yes. and committee members, my name is Linda Lafrenier, and as Amy mentioned, I'm a business partner of hers. Also, Stonebridge Kitchens, we're a design and remodeling firm, but we also have Minnesota Building Contractors License. So we do feel that some of the exemptions of this bill would restrict us in being able to, as Amy said, move into some other areas that we could certainly we're certainly qualified for, and we would ask that you would also say no to this bill.
Can you say your name and spell it for us? And then I'm going to ask everybody who's testified to please be sure that you've signed our roster of people who have testified. But if you could do that for us.
Okay, Linda Lafrenier, and my last name is spelled L-A, capital F-R-E-N-I-E-R.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We get that first name real easily, but it's that. It's a capital F, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Then Ron Sonic and Jamie, is it Corve? Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Hello. I bet you're Ron.
You can call me Ron for short.
Okay.
Madam Chair and committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to sit before you today. I am a residential remodeling contractor. I work in light commercial and residential construction. I've owned my business for 4 years, and I have 3 employees, so I'm a small business.
Can you say your name for us just for the, so we
sure.
can get it right.
Ron Sonic.
Thank you.
And prior to opening my remodeling business, I was a building official, so a building inspector for 9 years, so bring a unique perspective to this situation. And currently an instructor with the Building Inspection Technology Program with North Hennepin Community College. So there's 4 points that I wanted to leave you with today. Number one, from the building official perspective, is that the current rules and laws that are in place provide very good protection for the public, as I feel, with the architects taking the lead in all documents and design as it relates to commercial construction. Number two, from a business perspective, as it relates to my business with light commercial and residential construction, I understand one- and two-family dwellings being exempt, but in the light commercial side, I feel in these economic times that this legislation would restrict me in the talent pool that I can dip into as far as the designers that are available in the field. And with you know, basic economics, if there's a law of supply and demand where there's a lack of supply, prices will go up for contractors and consumers. Point number three that I'd like to bring up is there's been some discussion about the licensing and the one- and two-family exemption. If you look at the building contracting side of things, one- and two-family dwellings are licensed, which kind of goes counter to this legislation. And commercial buildings, if I wanted to go out and build a hospital tomorrow, I would not need a specific license to do so. And so what is looked at upon a larger project like that is that you have very sophisticated owners and buyers, that you're going to have professionals involved with those projects, with designers, contractors, code officials, and insurance companies all very closely working together on those types of projects. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And then just the fourth and final point that I have to keep it brief is that my perception of this bill is more about protecting a profession than it is about protecting the public. Thank you.
Mr. Sonic, thank you for being organized and to your point. I appreciate that. Welcome.
Welcome, Madam Chair and committee members. My sincere thanks for this opportunity to speak. I'm a little nervous, but it's dear to my heart.
That's good. If you'll just say your name for us.
Jamie Corby.
Corby?
Yes. I'm a student at Century College, enrolled in the Kitchen Bath Design Program that's accredited by the National Kitchen and Bath Association. I'm speaking on behalf of not only myself and my fellow classmates, but the hundreds of other students in the MNSCU programs that are to be soon graduates. Apart from my continuing education in kitchen bath design, I also hold an associate's degree in liberal arts with a global studies certificate. Many other interior design students like myself come into these MNSCU programs especially meet the needs of individuals that I know that are seeking new careers or are dislocated workers or have prior college degrees that no longer are suitable within our current job market and economy. Rather than transferring into a four-year school and obtaining my bachelor's degree as I had once planned on, I was fortunate enough to find my life calling and thought I had found the perfect program that would help make my dreams come true, or so I had thought. Never did I think I'd be standing up here talking to you, trying to defend myself in order to simply work in a field in the profession that I've chosen for myself without any restraints and, to the best of my knowledge, enrolled in the best program available. And this isn't that I believe that my education is over once I graduate this May. I have a firm conviction that learning is lifelong and one of the best investments I'll ever make. I value the opportunity to make my own choices concerning what I'd like to study, where I'd like to study, and with whom I'd like to study. I am not convinced that my attendance at a CETA-accredited program within the state and the completion of the NCIDQ exam to become licensed is the sole way to ensure the health, safety, and welfare of my future clients. Within my current education, I must incorporate guidelines and international residential codes, access codes, to ensure the health, safety, welfare of my clients, and to meet the required inspections and code compliance. After I complete my AKDB exam this fall, my next goals are to become LEED certified and CAP certified, which is certified aging in place. Incorporating all those great and wonderful things that I need to keep moving on.
You're doing great. I mean, I'm impressed that you came forward and are
With the aging baby boomer population, of which over 50% of Minnesota's population will be 55 and over by 2010, a place to live for as long as possible by the use of universal design. This includes non-slip materials, extended walkways and doorways, the contrast in colors and lighting for people who can't see Braille, all that I would be learning and certified in.
You're speaking to the right group.
With design, there are so many answers, and as a people, we are also different, which is a great reason why there have been so many successful and taxpaying designers within the state. I understand that those who approve this bill don't feel that my career is in jeopardy, but nowhere do I see that written in black and white or as a part of the bill. I do not trust that statement with my chosen career and life within their hands. There is no guarantee either that each NCDIQ certificate holder will be available to hire or even provide a 2-year paid internship for all the students who will be graduating year after year. I'm lucky enough to obtain an internship that's non-paid. It's more of a mentorship, but that's more than some of my other fellow classmates can even find right now. So within this economy, with the economy in the state it would be shameful for legislators to pass this bill and add thousands of currently taxpaying Minnesotans on top of the astronomical unemployment numbers that we have just seen within the last few months. Please oppose this bill, and my sincere thanks again.
Ms. Corvey, I hope you put on your resume that you have testified at the Minnesota Senate. I think you did really well. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm Galen L. Jurgensen.
I need you to say that. I don't think we had you on the list, so I...
Right.
Is your first name Galen?
Galen, G-A-L-E-N.
Yes.
L. Jurgensen, J-E-R-G-E-N-S-O-N.
Thank you. Mr. Jurgensen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam, and esteemed senators. I'm bringing a different twist to this hearing today. Is that I'm a grad from the Alexandria Technical College way back in the early 1970s. And then 5 years later, or 4 years later, I was called back to be a faculty. And I've been teaching for 34 years. On the last round from this particular Congress, a open-ended check was given to the Title Act of 1992. And in that, it spells out that we then had to be a fighter-accredited college. The year I started in 1975, we were the first 2-year program in the nation to be fighter accredited. By 2003, that had been taken away from us. We had not changed. We never had any representation on the board, so they never knew the voice. I have been on the board of NCIDQ. My credentials are 2 years. And in the idea of that, I see in hindsight the things that I have helped protect for my students have now eroded. As of 2003, my last graduating class are the only ones that can apply for any certification in Minnesota because the board that ends in ID, and I'm not going to try the architects, engineers.
We know which one it is.
Exactly. My students cannot escalate to the level of CID if they graduated after 2003. So if this is a commerce, it has already affected my students as far as what they can do, and there truly is a glass ceiling that has been placed in place and is now affecting all 2 years, okay? So with that said, we already understand we're a heavily regulated industry. The economy is pretty far down. Let's talk about the grads that are coming from not only Minnesota. Let's talk about the ones who are in our neighboring states. Now, here's the caveat. My students are very well trained. They're well esteemed. I have some in this room right now as we speak. After 34 years, I got a lot of eyes out there watching me. The idea, and I will keep this brief, but if this is enacted and they have to practice an internship after their internship in school, remember the three E's. Picture the E. The first E is education. Second E is the experience. And the third is the exam. Okay? To get to that exam, they have to have a monitored internship. Out of about 150, maybe 200, let's be generous here, of those 399 people, let's say that they have the ability to hire. Let's say that they have the wherewithal to add staff. Okay, the wave of people that come from Iowa and from neighboring states to do their internships here is not a hidden secret. My students will need to go across the bordering states to practice if this becomes that important for them to escalate. So the commerce is affected from all 2-year programs. okay? And we were initiated in 1967. There's been a lot of grads out there. Now, I'm going to put myself as an employer. How many people can I oversee for 2 years to have someone be effectively mentored along so that they could come to the point where they could take the exam? Okay? If there, let's just say that there are 300 grads coming out each year. And in the neighboring states, they can hire the first year. How about the second year? What about the third year? Now, we have some economic problems here. First of all, they're all paid. We've heard that all internships are paid. I won't set a student out without being paid for, because you get what you pay for. But if you do the math, if you run this scenario, there are not going to be enough places to train these individuals to become eligible to escalate to their licensing requirements.
Okay, I think I understand. And are you saying that there's already a problem given qualifications?
The Title Act
requirements. Okay.
The Title Act has in it, in the rules, that you must come from a FITER or a CETA accredited college. The CETA pulled that away. We knew that a decade ago.
That's got to be with certified interior design accreditation.
Accreditation, okay. Correct. Okay.
And then what's the F? What's the?
Well, it's just that my students will probably be going to other states to practice, okay. Or they will probably not practice at all.
Okay. Mr. Jurgensen, thank you, and thank you for being patient.
Thank you.
I have Ms. Schmelzer, and is it Lushin? And I'm going to give you like about a minute each. I'm sorry if you can talk really fast.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm not an architect. I'm not an interior designer.
But tell us your name.
I am Joy Schmelzer.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. I am the Senior Marketing Manager for LK Cabinet Division based in Waconia. We are the fourth largest kitchen and bath manufacturer in the country. We have three manufacturing facilities in Minnesota and approximately 750 Minnesota employees. On behalf of those employees, I'd like to urge you to vote against what we see as unnecessary regulation. This legislation or any legislation which would limit the number of people who are eligible to specify kitchen and bath cabinetry for residential or commercial products would negatively impact our business. Any negative impact in this business right now in Minnesota or any other state would be very, very detrimental to protecting the 750 manufacturing jobs that we have here in the state of Minnesota. The kitchen and bath cabinet industry in 2008 was about an $8.5 billion industry nationwide. That was a 25% contraction over 2007. We cannot afford to have fewer specifiers in the field. As our medallion cabinetry brand, we sell through Menards, which sells to general contractors. We've done projects for hotels, you know, the little kitchenettes with the kitchen and bath cabinetry. I'm not sure that would be permitted under this legislation. We've done projects for timeshares. I'm not sure that would be permitted under this legislation. We've done projects for resorts. We did a project recently for a golf course. It was in the state of Florida, but it was a golf course, but it was a set of beautiful wood lockers. I'm not sure that we would have been allowed to make that sale in the state of Minnesota under this legislation. So make no mistake about it. Any decrease in the number of specifiers will result in higher costs and fewer manufacturing jobs in our company and in the many other manufacturers who supply this industry.
Ms. Schmelzer, is a specifier the person who places the order, who's...
Exactly. It could be an architect. It could be an interior designer. It could be a kitchen and bath designer. It could be one of our staff members who's a certified kitchen and bath designer or a product specialist.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, if you look in the bill, page 2, starting on line 27, Ms. Schmelzer says she's not sure whether she could make those sales here in Minnesota. But one of the exemption, it says nothing contained in this applies to, an employer or owner of a retail establishment providing consultation in the furtherance of a retail sale or prospective retail sale regarding interior finishing, furnishings, or cabinetry on behalf of the retail establishment. That pretty clearly says to me that she would indeed be able to continue doing those sales here in Minnesota.
With all due respect, we are a manufacturer. We are not a retailer. We do have channel partners who are resellers of our products, such as Menards and Lowe's, who are retailers, but we are a manufacturing facility.
Okay, I think what Senator Higgins is saying is that a Menards, for example, would be exempt,
okay,
and they would be able to order from you. Their salesperson,
buyer. Right.
I think, am I right, Senator Higgins? That's what you were
saying.
They
sell to Menards and Lowe's and whoever, and that entity, that retailer then, sells to the ultimate buyer.
Okay,
well, thank you for explaining my business to me, but we do work through multiple channels of distribution, one of which is retail. We also are distributed direct to builders and commercial developers, and that would be the business that would handle things typically like the commercial projects we're talking about today. We did have, as I mentioned, a Menards project, which involved a hotel, but that's very unusual. We do sell direct to the building industry.
Are you saying that because are you drawing to this conclusion because you think there would be fewer people who would be doing the work because it would be restricted,
right,
to people? I wasn't sure I was following the connection, but
if you restrict the number of people who are allowed to specify cabinetry and who are allowed to do a cabinetry design and layout for a room, then you will cause financial harm to our business as well as the other cabinet manufacturers located within the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much. And
we're
going to, members, I would like us to be able to vote today. And Senator Prettner-Solon has a committee meeting. I have a bill in front of a committee
meeting
at 3 o'clock and that I'm carrying. So we need to move along here.
Thank you
very much. Was Lisa Lushin here?
Okay,
thank you. Mr. Nagorski, did you want to just...
If I could take Lisa for 2 seconds, really just
briefly,
to clarify the retail exemption.
If you're from New Jersey, I'm going to let you do that.
Thank you very much. I'm flying right out as soon as we're done to Florida. regarding the retail exemption, the reason that the Retail Association, not only in Minnesota but throughout the country, opposes this is because they do not just do consultation regarding selection of furnishings or cabinetry. This would prevent them from doing design work. Not consultation. And Menards and Home Depot and Lowe's and Best Buy, who's located here, and I also understand talking to them, they're opposing this as well, don't just do selection or consultation. Best Buy, for example, a good segment of their business is in home theaters or media centers in offices. They would be barred from doing that design work if this bill were to be passed, unless, of course, they had a licensed interior designer on staff. Thank you again for allowing me to continue.
Senator Higgins, did you want to say
Ms. Paris could.
Yes, Ms. Paris, welcome.
Hi, Madam Chair. Julie Paris with Larkin Hoffman. I just want to simply quickly address what I think is a bit confusing. What you're being told is that somehow there's a new exemption that may prohibit some of these folks from doing the work that they're already doing. The exemptions in the bill are simply referenced language to existing exemptions in statute that apply to every single profession licensed under the board. The folks that are sitting back there and telling you that this will somehow change what they do, that's not accurate. The exemptions already allow them to do what they're doing. We simply reference those exemptions to make it clear that those spaces are exempt under the bill. Those exemptions are existing in our building code as well.
Okay, I don't know if I track that 100%, but I mean, I know what you said, and you said it clearly. I don't see the manufacturers mentioned in here. They're not. It's about the retail store, the employee of a retail establishment, and a manufacturer isn't that.
Madam Chair,
but
this is about the chain of this is about the chain of sale. The manufacturer would not be impacted by this bill. This is about the chain of sale.
Okay, members, do you have any questions for Senator Higgins or any further discussion? Can I somebody move the bill?
I'll
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 376. Recommend to pass as amended.
Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 376 as amended be recommended to pass. I don't think it's been asked to go anyplace else.
Does it have rulemaking, Madam Chair?
Well,
is there rulemaking, Senator Higginson?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, there isn't new rulemaking. The authority already exists for the board to do the rulemaking.
Yeah. Otherwise, it would, Madam Chair, you'd have to go to the local government ops.
They have not requested the bill, Madam Chair, Senator
Metzen. I don't care if they requested it, but it would have to go there by the Senate rules. On this one, that's
President says
so. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, we've talked with state and local, and I think Council Chris Stang might be able to address this as well. The bill doesn't contain any new rulemaking authority, which would trigger the state and local government operations oversight of the bill. Any new rulemaking would do that. They have the existing authority under their current under the current board to do what we're asking them to do, which is update the rules that exist.
Right. They'd have to do rulemaking, but they already have the authority.
Yes. That's what you're
saying. Madam Chair, that's a better answer than
that. Yeah. And then they don't want it. Yeah. Fair enough.
On the Sparks motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. Division.
I was going to say the motion fails.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I don't know. I don't even know how you voted. So, so the motion does not prevail. Senator Higgins, thank you for your consideration
today.
And I think that the committee listened hard. It's a bit complex. Thank everybody in the room for being respectful and cooperative, and we are not meeting on Thursday because people are on tour. And so, members, we are meeting, however, next Tuesday, and we're going to be hearing a bill that I have having to do with mediation for homeowners and lenders. So, with that, the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.